I'm going to start with the Richard Dawkins quote that we began with at the very first night. So Richard Dawkins says, to believe in a God is to squander your precious time on worshipping, sacrificing, fighting and dying. To believe in a God is to squander your precious time on worshipping, sacrificing, fighting and dying. Now what do you think? After three talks on the resurrection from 1 Corinthians 15, what do you think about that as Dawkins' sort of assessment of what we've been doing? Or put that slightly more unsettlingly, do you realise that for three talks here, I have effectively been what the tabloids would call the mad mullah, haven't I? I don't know how the headline would go, the mad mullah of Wellingborough or something like that. Do you remember the cartoon, one of the bits of cartoons after July the 7th? Of a Muslim cleric strapping a load of bombs onto a little boy and saying, go on, my son, go and be brave, while he hid in the shadows. That's the view of the mad mullah. Isn't that what I've done this week? The sort of evil cleric speaking to young, impressionable people and saying, destroy yourself. That's what the mullah says, isn't it? Destroy yourself. It's worth it. You'll go straight to Allah. You'll have 70 virgins in the next life. Is this really so? Can you tell the difference between that and 1 Corinthians 15? Richard Dawkins certainly can't tell the difference between that and what we've been saying this week. This chapter is utterly life-changing, isn't it? This isn't just a sort of, try harder if you would please sort of chapter, is it? This chapter is die every day. You can waste this life, spend it, destroy it, because you have a second, better body to come. Now, I say that partly because I wouldn't want to do anything so significant to you, sort of covertly, secretly. I wouldn't want to have actually left you here sort of deciding to give up your life without making that clear to you, so that you can say, my brain is involved here. I don't want to do that unless I've decided. I'm not going to do it because the mad mullah says so. I'm only going to do it if I think the Bible says, and if I think what the Bible says is true, if I think it stacks up, I think it adds up. This is a big deal, isn't it? This chapter is everything that Richard Dawkins is afraid of about religion. We, at the LSE Mission, we had one of the talks we called Why Religious Extremism is Good. Why Extremism is Good. The point we were making was that extremism is just a given. It's not all right to be moderately obedient to your gods, just like it's not all right to be moderately keen on your wife. Extremism is a given when we talk about God, in belief in a transcendent God. The problem isn't the extremism. The problem is only the things that your God tells you to do. That's where society should have a problem with extreme religion. Does your God tell you to do good things or bad things? And also the only other problem is whether your God is real or not. Is it a true, real God telling you to do these things? And are they good things or are they terrible things? It's not actually extremism that's... This is a very extreme chapter. It's not actually extremism that's the problem. So it's exactly the same issue as 1 Corinthians 15. It tells you to die every day. So the issues are, is the death we're called to, is it a good one or a bad one? Is it doing good or is it doing terrible things? And is the God who tells us to do it, is he real? And is the future he's offering, is it true? It's not the extremism. I hope you notice the extremism. But it's not the extremism that's the problem. It's, is it a good thing to do? And is it true? Now, verses 50 to 58, they're Paul's conclusion, really. And there'll be lots in those verses that is familiar from what we've looked at already. But this time, I think the sort of big difference is it's sort of familiar, but this time with yarr! Okay, that's the big difference here. This is the... We're concluding, we're shouting, we're excited. This is what he's building up to verse 58. In particular, building up to say, be steadfast, be immobile in this. He's under no illusion. This is big stuff he's asked you to do. It would utterly change the Corinthians, the whole way they run their lives and their church. It's a big deal. And a good check of whether you are persuaded in and of yourself, you're actually in your head you're persuaded, rather than just going along with it because there's a nice bunch of us here and we're all saying we believe it, rather than being tricked by the evil cleric. A good way to check is whether you are happy joining Paul in saying yarr to death. Are you happy saying that? Are you happy laughing at death? That's what we're going to try and do in these eight verses. Are you happy shouting and jeering, taunting death? That's a way of checking whether you really believe it. So we've got three headings. They are not actually the three that are on your sheet, though they're pretty similar, you'll see. So first heading, verses 50 to 52. First heading, all change. All change. Verses 50 to 52. And I think it looks like Paul is answering one final objection. I think the objection is something like this. All right, Paul. So when Jesus comes, I've got it, dead bodies, dead people will rise. That's okay. And Jesus will sort them out. But what about us? What if Jesus comes back and we're still alive and all these dead bodies are getting their better bodies? What about, are we going to be stuck with this? What's going to happen to us? Do you expect us to go to heaven with these bodies? Now, I'm not sure it's a great objection, actually. I think that's what Paul's going into. That's the new thing in these verses. And Paul's answer is, we will all change, all of us, corpses and us living bodies, on the day Jesus returns. So do you see each verse from 50 to 52 has two groups in it? Each verse has two groups in it. Verse 50, you've got flesh and blood on one side and the perishable on the other side. 53, you've got this perishable body or this mortal body. Same again in 54, perishable and mortal. Now, you may think this is absolutely obvious. I hadn't ever understood this until this week. The two groups, those two groups, flesh and blood or mortal and perishable, they're the same two groups as in verse 52. The same two groups, not just two ways of describing dead bodies. You've got the dead who will be raised, and the other group is us, we, who will be changed. Do you think that's obvious? I hadn't seen that. So it's when Jesus comes back, there will be two groups of people. There'll be the lot who are dead, who are perished, who are rotten, and are dribbly and oozy. And then there are the lot who will need to be changed, who are mortal. We have mortal bodies, we're dying, and will need to be changed. And verse 51, even though we shall not all sleep, there's a group who won't be dead when Jesus comes back, but we shall all be changed. So the perished, rotten, runny corpses will be changed into imperishable, glorious new bodies. That's what we said last night. And those of us in mortal, dying, fading bodies like these will be changed and will put on immortality. The last trumpet will sound like the loudest alarm clock ever. Who missed breakfast this morning? Anyone miss breakfast? No one. That's amazing. There we go. Like the loudest alarm clock ever. And we, if we're still alive, will put on immortality, like your alarm clock going off and getting dressed for the first time ever in your life. An immortality that it says we'll put on. It's quite a suit of clothes, isn't it? Quite a suit of clothes to put on. Just remember their culture. Corinth is a city very near Mount Olympus. So in their culture, they really believe in the immortals. Mount Olympus, that's where the immortals live. We're talking Zeus and Hephaestus and Poseidon and these sort of people. And if Jesus came back this instant, if he came back this moment, that is what would happen to you if you're a Christian believer. Be changed into an immortal body. And all the emphasis here is on excitement and on the speed with which it happens. Does this excite you? Verse 51, behold, I tell you a mystery. We won't all sleep, but we will all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, can you hear it? And the dead will be raised imperishable, and we shall be changed. Yeah, hold on to your seats as Jesus returns and instantaneously makes you immortal, raises up your dead loved ones, and prepares you for his new world. Can you go yarr at the thought of that? Trumpet, we're not very big on sort of trumpets blowing anymore, are we? The trumpet blows, Jesus our Saviour returns, death is over. Can you go with the excitement? Death is defeated. See, that's point two. So that's point two. So all change, point two, is death defeated. All change, point two, is death defeated. Verses 53 to 55. And this is familiar, I think, from verses 24 to 28. If you were here that night, we said our resurrection is what defeats death. They're not two separate things. It's not like God defeats death over here, kicks him in the head, and then says, shall I or not? Shall I give them new bodies? Maybe I will, maybe I won't. All right, go on then, because he's kind. The two things are related. Verse 54, when the perishable puts on the imperishable and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. So if God wants to defeat death, if that's something he's interested in doing, then the resurrection of Christians is absolutely necessary. Verse 53, this body must, it's necessary, must put on, and this mortal body must. There's no defeat of death without that. And the defeat of death, we heard from Satchi, it's been written into God's plan from the very, very beginning. In fact, since before the first death, God has been planning to send Jesus to do this. And all the way through his revelation of what God is up to, what is the big deal, what is the big plan, never really sort of people in a land, never really that family. The big deal always has been the eternal defeat of death. We're going to turn back to one Old Testament passage, the one that Paul quotes there. It's in Isaiah 25. So you need to find Psalms that are right in the middle and then flick on forwards to the book of Isaiah and chapter 25. Isaiah chapter 25. It might be page 708 if you have a regulation issue ESV. And Isaiah 25 is a very appropriate place to go for a chapter about physical bodies in a new creation, because the picture here of God's new world is extremely physical. Are you hungry for lunch? Anyone hungry for lunch? There we go. That is your own fault. Verse 6. How's this for a picture of God's new creation? On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, a rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. Isn't that a great picture? Rich food, full of marrow, which I take it Isaiah was keen on. That's something he thinks is a good thing. You can sort of feel the fat dripping down your face as you stuff this rich food into yourself. You can smell the wine, well-aged, well-refined. Heaven is not a floaty thing in the Bible. Heaven is an enormous pig-out feast. That's how it talks about it. But actually, it's not just the people eating, verse 7. God is eating as well. He will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. But what is it? What is the veil that's been spread out over everybody, hiding them, shadowing them? Verse 8, he will swallow up death forever. Like death's a little sort of hors d'oeuvre. There he is. And God swallows up death forever. The Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces. And there is everything from Genesis 3 to Revelation 21 poured in together, isn't it? Death covers over everybody since Adam. All die in Adam. But on that day, Revelation 21, when Jesus returns, the trumpet sounds, and God opens his huge mouth and swallows up death forever. Or in the way Paul translates it, death is gone because death is swallowed up in victory forever. Swallowed up in victory, no more tears. And Paul's point back in 1 Corinthians is that God won't have done that. God won't have swallowed up death in victory until he has sorted out both of our groups. Both groups need to be sorted out for that to happen. Needs to sort out smelly, perishing corpses and dying mortal us. Just imagine if he left out that second group and had just made the new creation for the corpses. 70 years on, we'd have a problem in the new creation, wouldn't we? Because all of us with our mortal bodies who'd gone there, suddenly they're having to bury us. The generation that was still alive when Jesus came back, suddenly they're dying. And resurrected mothers are suddenly have to bury their children who didn't get the proper bodies. The children who buried them the first time round. It's a bit confusing, isn't it? Can you see how ridiculous that would be? As if God had sort of just forgotten to sort out this generation. He'd only sorted out the ones before. That's not a victory over death, which is just another way of saying what Paul has been saying all along. This must happen. God's entire plan, reputation, stake, intentions, power, promises, truthfulness, it is all staked on this. Every promise from Isaiah 25 round and on is staked on it. Do you believe it enough to see the defeat of death coming and yell yarr at him today? Verse 55, they're taunting death. They're chanting them at death, taunting him. Do you know the people still watch the Monty Python, the Holy Grail? Your mother was a hamster. Well, that's sort of, is it that? Is that an exact, I don't know. But it's that, it's us saying that to death. Death, you pathetic, feeble, foolish, where's your victory? Where's your sting? You've lost it. Stupid death. Do you ever wonder why flags fly at half mast when someone dies? Do you ever wonder that? Do you know why they fly at half mast? Or ever wonder why it isn't really half mast at all? It's sort of just sort of slightly down. Do you know why? Here is why. You bring the flag of death down. You bring the flag down to leave just enough room for another flag above it. The invisible flag of death. We're in the world of master and commander, or hornblower, that sort of world, where you capture the enemy fleet. You shift the horrible French flag down a bit, and you stick the British flag above. Now, I'm pretty keen on that sort of book. I'm currently have a whole line of these on my shelf. No one will ever have read these. No one's ever heard of them. They're fantastic. Bolitho? Alexander Kent. There you go. One sensible man at the back. Fantastic. Fantastic stuff. I love to have been alive in that world. You charge on the enemy fleet, all swords and pistols, and they surrender, and you stick up the British flag over the top. Every human death, every single human death is a conquest. Every time somebody dies, you run down the flag of life and you put death over the top. Death sticks his horrible, invisible flag over the top of it. And the best moments in naval history are when the smoke clears for just a second and you see an English ship drifting in the wrong direction that's been captured. And over the English flag is that French flag. You see it drifting off and Captain hatches a plan and launches the boats and catches the enemy by surprise. And they storm on board cheering, yarr! And the captain turns to the person next to him very calmly, turns to his coxswain and says, Brown, take that flag down and run the colours up. And it's that sort of moment, every single human being captured by death from Adam, every single one of Adam and Eve's children captured by death, horrible, drifting the wrong way until Jesus Christ, who rose. And he is not just a one-off victory just for Jesus. He is a life-giving spirit, we said. And when his trumpet sounds and the captain comes back, then every single one of those flags is torn down. And his people are given new, glorious, transformed bodies. The captain says, run up the real flag, the flag of life. And this is the total and utter defeat of death. Are you happy taunting him? Are you happy jeering at death? Pathetic death, you've lost. Where is your sting? Where's your victory? God has swallowed you, chomped and gnashed and swallowed you. It's a good test of how much I really believe this. Am I happy sneering at death? It's quite revealing. I've only got to sort of wind up for a big yarr at death, and I feel a sort of twinge in my shoulder. And wonder if death's going to get me back for being cheeky. Or just wonder what might happen on the car journey back. Are you happy jeering at death? Do you see death as a weak, foolish thing? But it's stupid. I know Jesus rose. I know he rose. I know the defeat of death in my resurrection is inevitable. And laughing at death is appropriate. It's pure playground stuff, verse 55. In fact, the stupidity of death is so great, isn't it? Death killed Jesus. What a stupid thing to do. The death of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, destroyed death forever, and he's swallowed up in victory. We should be able to taunt death. It doesn't take away the sadness at all that we feel when a loved one is not with us anymore. It doesn't take that away for one second, what it's like to live on earth now and not have the people with us that we love and want to be here. But 1 Thessalonians says we don't grieve like other men who have no hope. We're looking ahead to the final defeat of stupid death. And there is one big difference between 1 Corinthians 15 and the mad mullah of the tabloids. One big difference to a suicide bomber. You see, yes, this chapter is telling you to spend your life throw it away, waste it in human speaking terms. But it isn't into death. This isn't a chapter that loves death. This isn't a chapter that wants to cause death as you throw your life away. This is a chapter that is against death, that hates death, that is cheering about the defeat and destruction of death. Here's a new reason to bother, a new reason why our labor and our work isn't in vain. Because our struggle in the work of the Lord is working towards the defeat of death. We're working for the most amazing, wonderful, complete victory there has ever been. Why wouldn't you want to abound in the work of the Lord if it is as exciting as calling people to believe in Jesus? Believe in Jesus, have their sins taken away, have life. If that is like storming the ship with your captain, like our non-Christian friends, the people death has captured, that death shouldn't have control of, and our captain is saying, let's go and get them, man the boats. Let's go and find them and pull death's flag down. Doesn't that change the way we feel about our work for the Lord, especially our evangelism? I find it huge hard work, don't you? Huge hard work. You need time to spend being a proper friend to people, so you're not just a sort of Bible doorstep friend. You need time to pray for people. It is labor and hard work setting up a dialogue supper. Has anyone done that yet? Did anyone book a speaker last night? It's labor and hard work, isn't it? It's hard work organizing a mission this term, those of you who will be doing that at King's and Imperial and UCL. Evangelism, frankly, is terrifying, isn't it? It's labor and hard work, terrifying, a bit like war. But it is worth it. It is worth it, it says. Let's say that you give loads and loads of time to this, loads of time to evangelism, so that it really costs you. Let's imagine what it might cost you this year if you gave loads and loads of time to trying to seek people out and give them life. Let's say it cost you a whole degree class. Okay, let's say it moved you from getting a first to getting a 2-1. What would that cost you? It'd be quite a big cost, wouldn't it? Let's run that through your life. In 3 years' time, I guess that would mean you'd have a different job, probably, if you missed the degree class like that. In 10 years' time, I guess it would mean you'd be earning, I don't know, £10,000 less a year, £20,000 less a year, if you did that. In 30 years' time, maybe it would mean you're earning £100,000 less per year. Maybe it would mean that. Missing that. In 50 years' time, it would mean you'd have a nicer pension, which means you'd be playing more golf. But how about in 100 years' time? Or 1,000 years' time? Let's say when you're walking around the new creation in your new body, with your friend who became a Christian because you gave up that time this term to tell them about the gospel. Here is one thing I guarantee they will never say as you walk around. I guarantee they will never say, I wish you hadn't spent all that time telling me about Jesus. I wish you'd worked harder at your degree. I guarantee they'll never say that. Now, I'm not saying don't do any work this term, but here's an observation. I think students now work significantly harder than students when I was a student. I think maybe twice as hard. Obviously, there's a range here. I'm not talking to everyone. But I think twice as hard. And my cynical view is to ask, what is it that has changed in 10 years since I was a student? I don't think exams haven't got harder. I don't think the Bible commands to do your work properly as if for the Lord, I don't think those have changed. I think the only change that's happened is that you now pay for your studies, whereas I got paid to study. I think that's the only difference. See, I hear things like students complaining when a lecture is cancelled. I say, I've paid for this. I was nowhere near the lectures to even know if they'd been cancelled, which that's probably not a good model either. But you pay for them, so you want value for money, so you work hard, so you don't waste your degree. Now, if that is you, if you're not one of the lazy people, just ask yourself, wouldn't you rather labour for the amazing, awesome victory of Jesus over death? Of course, those things needn't be totally exclusive. But if when you're making choices, which would you rather labour for? To be at the captain's side on the day he says, there's one, go and get that one. Run the colours up over him or her. So I'm moderately excited about having a baby in the family. I actually found inside my copy of Richard Dawkins is the timings of Claire's contractions. There you go. So moderately excited about having a baby. That was quite a fun day when we had a baby. That's nice, woohoo. But evangelism and conversion, that is giving birth to a new indestructible life that can never spoil or fade. Is anything more fun than that? Is anything more fun? I said I tried to pick up the pace with some of my friends a couple of years ago in terms of being a bit more willing to die every day and a bit more willing to even lose friends in telling them about the gospel. And we got to that point with one of my closest friends from school. His name's Penn, which is a silly name. Closest friend. We've been skiing and camping and walking together since the second year of school. I'd been inviting him to things on and off for 15 years. But I picked up the pace and got to a sort of decision moment where it was that sort of, he's sort of understanding the gospel. He's either going to hate it and reject it and I'll probably lose a friend, or I need to keep on evangelizing. Which am I going to do? Got to that decision point, and amazingly, by God's grace, carried on. And Penn became a Christian last year. Did Christianity Explored at St. Helens. He went on to the follow-up stuff. We started meeting up to read Colossians. Was that worth the labour? Was that worth the labour? There's nothing more exciting has happened to me. Death? You've lost him, death. You've lost him. You've slipped up. Penn will rise on the last day with a new body and he will live forever. Verse 55 is his big taunting raspberry. That's what it is. Can you join in with that? Now, Paul is he's finished his chapter, really. But as he is chanting Sting, it just reminds him of something else. So we're going to finish with third point. I don't know if this will help in the months to come. Third point, completely different from what you got on the sheet. Third point, not just a future victory. Not just a future victory. Verse 56 and 57. See, when he says sting, it helps him imagine death. So 2 nights ago, we imagined death as like the final boss at the end of the computer game. He's the last enemy. And now we can dress him up with Paul's help. Death is the scorpion, isn't he, from this? He's ugly. He's huge. He is equipped with fearsome strength and a deadly sting, verse 56, which is sin. And that's a picture that works, isn't it? Every sin that we've committed since Adam has led straight to death. Like death is the sort of scuttling scorpion with his stinger full of poison, slapping round each of us and killing us every time we sin. And even the law, it says in verse 56, God's law makes it worse. The power of sin is the law, it says. It's like the law gives sin a sort of mega booster. That would be a shock in a computer game, wouldn't it? If the bosses could get the power-ups. That's what we're saying. Law is like that. It's like pressing the accelerator on sin. I think we had an example of that on the first night here. The centre very kindly provided an example. Do you remember that? So when Chris or Clive stood up to speak and give us the sort of safety briefing, there was it was staggering, wasn't it? The moment when he said, have any of you brought any fireworks with you? Have any of you intending to set off any fireworks in your room? And we all sort of looked at him briefly, like, that's, who do you think we are? Yeah, that's right, I always carry a major arsenal with me, just in case. And then he said, well, please don't set them off. And did anyone else just with every fibre of your being long to go and find some fireworks? Like, I will drive to Milton Keynes or wherever and let them off in my room, down your nice long corridors. Now that you said it. That's the effect. That's other parts of the Bible explain. That's how the law has that effect on sin. Even God's law, which says great things, don't murder, don't steal, don't lie, just saying it accelerates sin, gives power to sin, which is the poison in the stinger of scorpion death, scary old death. And you could think these verses are just heading for same as everything else. Thank goodness, scorpion death is going to be destroyed one day. Thank goodness there'll be a day when God will finally put the jam jar on the scorpion, take him away, and it'll be safe for us to go out and play again. You could think that's what it's saying. But actually, just look at verse 57 more closely. Verse 57, look at the verb. What tense is the verb in? Thanks be to God, who gives us the victory. He talks about it in the present tense. Point three, this is not just a future victory. Because sin and law, which are death's entire armory, that's all he's got in the bank, sin and law, that is his whole armory. Sin and law are the things that through our Lord Jesus Christ are already disarmed. Already disarmed. He's done that. So imagine the scorpion again, scuttling around and slashing and poisoning and killing people. Jesus Christ takes hold of the stinger and sinks it into himself on the cross. That was our first thing of first importance back in verse 3 at the beginning of the chapter. Jesus Christ died for sins. He takes on the sin of Christians, takes on all the death and punishment deserved for them. Just imagine that man, Jesus Christ. Just imagine him doing that. I don't know if, since we're in the world of naval history and sort of medals and victories and battles, what sort of medal would you give Jesus Christ for going up against the scorpion and stabbing himself with all of our sin and death? You know, we give people medals for the guy who dived on the grenade to protect his friend's lives. Jesus Christ takes all of sin and death and stabs it into himself and dies. He dies, but he is not defeated. He dies, but he rises, which means that sin and law are done with. That sin and law are exactly what Jesus died for 2,000 years ago. Count them. 2,000 years ago, Jesus Christ dealt with sin and law, finished them off. This is not just a future victory that we're to hope is true in the future. This is an already victory, and we have it now. Yet there's a final sense of the day when we die, day when we rise. But for now, as Christians, death waggles his tail and slashes out at us with it. But death is not Shelob from the Lord of the Rings. Death is a poodle. Menacing us with his pom-pom on the end of his tail. Death's stinger has been drawn. He can thump it around. He can cause us great sorrow with our friends as they die. But actually, we can look at death with his stinger, his little tail, and say, oh, bless. Death hasn't really worked it out yet. His time is over. Jesus has dealt with everything he had in his armory. We're only waiting for the return of the captain, the trumpet to blow, and in an instant, death is over, swallowed up. My sin cannot hurt me. The sin I do doesn't give death poison. It's all into Jesus Christ. Doesn't lead me to death. So suicide bombers, is this suicide bombers? Is this just sort of trickery or offering 70 virgins? I hope that hasn't been our method this week. I hope there's been enough space for you to think critically about what we've been saying. I didn't intend to carry anyone along on a sort of, well, hey, death's gone, don't you believe it really? I think there is hard facts to think about, hard evidence in Jesus Christ, the evidence, the witness, the way all these things fit together across the entire Bible. I hope there's no trickery. I hope you're persuaded rather than tricked. I hope also you see the massive difference. Paul's aim is utterly different from the aim of the mullah who sets up a suicide bomber. He wants you to go and have an effect on other people, which brings them life and happiness and freedom and hope. That is what he's asking you to spend your life for. It is an unutterably good thing that he's asking you to do. And the motive is, it's not 70 virgins, but a victory, a new body with God. A perfect body in holiness, in service of other people, in enjoying that, in being the good, perfect person we wish we could be. It's not a self-indulgent future. And also the sort of appeal to it isn't just future. I'm the guy, you know, cross your fingers, hope it'll be true, and maybe it will be. And this is a victory we experience now. As you sin and realize you're forgiven, as you love knowing Jesus has drawn the sting of death and sin, then already you're experiencing this victory. And as you look back to his resurrection and the witnesses and all the evidence, say this is a real event with a new body to come. And having said all of that, wouldn't you love to be, verse 58, Wouldn't verse 58 be a brilliant New Year's resolution? Brilliant thing to write across this year. Wouldn't you love to be those things? Just look at verse 58. In fact, if chapter 15 is true, then verse 58 is the least I want to do. If chapter 15 is true. Which means I want to cultivate this year, 2008, cultivate a vivid, real, personal sense of my future resurrection, of my future body, so that verse 58 can be real in my life as well. I want to suggest that, just pick up verse 58. Let's stand. Stand up, bring verse 58 with you. That's pretty tricky. And turn and look at each other. Don't look at me, turn and look at each other. You are the church, or the student part of it. You are St. Helens, 2008. If verse 58 is what you would like to do with 2008, look at each other now. So you need to be able to remember two or three words at once. Hold a finger where it is. I find that helps. Turn to each other. And again, remember we're in the YAR! So don't read this sort of wimperly. And let's read this to each other as this is what we are going to do together. If you're persuaded, no one has to, there's no sort of clerical power here. But if you're persuaded, turn to each other and let's say this to each other. Are we ready? Let's say it together. Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immobile, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labour is not in vain. Why not just sit down and turn to your neighbour maybe and pray for them. Pray verse 58 for them. And then Reese is going to come back up.